Chapter 11. 31st of October, 12:30 a.m. 5.5 hours until low tide.
Don't be cross, Trixie says to Lily, as we all crowd into the lounge. I tried to watch television, but this started playing instead.
She points at the ancient wooden TV cabinet, and I spot Nana's old VCR player. She never upgraded to DVDs, in the same way she refused to listen to music on anything other than vinyl records on her 1950s jukebox. The retro TV set rarely worked anyway, especially in a storm, so our only screen-shaped entertainment as kids, when we were here, was Nana's VHS collection. It's probably why we all spent so much time outside. I remember the home movies lined up on the shelf last night, and see that they are gone. The shelf is empty. All I can see on the TV is a flickering image of a baby, until Lily snatches the remote from her daughter and hits the play button. The screen is filled with a close-up of Nana's face, but she looks 30 years younger. She's carrying a baby into this room, which looks exactly the same, and it takes a while for me to realise that the child is me. My dad was a bit obsessed with making home movies when we were little kids, but I don't think I've ever seen this one before. And I'm not sure any of us really want to watch it now. And the rest of the Darker family can't wait to meet you, says Nana. She carefully passes baby me to my mother, who looks so much younger. Nancy looks tired but very beautiful, and still has a hospital ID tag around her wrist. This must be the day they brought me home to Seaglass. I always knew I was born when we were here. Shall I go and fetch Rose and Lily now? Says Nana's voice, out of shot. They've both been very patient waiting to meet their new baby sister. The camera seems to nod, and I realise that my dad must have been holding it. I want to switch off the home movie, but Nancy takes the remote from Lily and sits on the very edge of the sofa closest to the television. I'm touched, at first, that she wants to remember this moment. But then I see that she is staring at herself on the screen, not me. The image of my past wobbles as my father puts the camera down on the table so that he can be in shot. He comes to stand next to my mother as she lays me in an old-fashioned baby crib before rocking me back and forth. Dad has long, slightly shocking 1970s hair and is wearing what looks like a comedy moustache and flared jeans. The other thing that is noticeably different from the man we know today is that he looks happy. They both do. I watch, transfixed, just like everyone else, as 5-year-old Rose and 4-year-old Lily are led into the room, each holding one of Nana's hands. They are wearing matching yellow dresses covered in a pretty lemon print. I remember wearing the same dress myself a few years later, when it had faded from being washed so many times. My clothes were rarely new when I was a little girl. I only ever got to wear what Rose and Lily had grown out of. Rose's hair is tied back in a high ponytail on the TV screen, almost exactly like the one she has now, with the same chunky fringe, while Lily has pigtails tied with yellow ribbons. My mother often dressed them like twins. There was only a 10-month age gap, so it wasn't surprising. My sisters take it in turns to peer inside the crib, and, unlike now, we really do look like a happy family.
This is all very sweet, but what are we going to do about the situation in the kitchen?
Asks Connor, interrupting the moment. My father stares at him, as though he had forgotten Connor was here, then helps himself to a glass of whisky from the drinks trolley in the corner of the room.
What do you suggest we do about the situation? He asks Connor, before taking a large gulp. Call the police.
Here we go again, says Lily.
Why would we call the police? She was 80, says Nancy. Connor folds his arms. Because I'm not convinced she died of natural causes.
Dad laughs.
You think one of us did her in?
Would you mind not suggesting such hateful things in front of Trixie? Says Lily, opening a packet of cigarettes and lighting one. The things she says and does to protect her child are almost always outweighed by the things she says and does to hurt her. I notice that Lily's fingers are trembling and wonder if it is the cold or the need for nicotine or something else causing it. Trixie seems not to have heard a thing and is still staring at the home movie on the TV screen. Besides, the landline doesn't work and neither does my mobile. The tide won't go back out for a few hours yet, so calling the coroner, the police, or anyone else will have to wait a while.
I could take the boat, go and get help,
Connor suggests.
No, says my father. This is a family matter and needs to be dealt with in a sensitive, private way.
Connor might be right, says Rose, and everyone turns to stare at her. It's at least 5 hours until the tide goes out. We ought to report what has happened here tonight.
I could go with him, she suggests,
before turning to Connor.
If you don't mind. I don't think that's a good idea, says Frank,
playing the protective father card I never knew he'd been dealt. Nobody asks why.
Then maybe I could go alone? Rose suggests. It might look a little bit strange if we don't try to get help. It shouldn't take me too long, if you don't mind me borrowing the boat, Connor.
He shrugs in agreement. My father nods at Rose, and the matter is settled surprisingly quickly, almost as if they had rehearsed this whole exchange.
Why do you get to leave?
Lily asks, taking another drag on her cigarette.
Because she's barely touched a drink all night, unlike the rest of us, and Rose has always been the most sensible one in the family,
Dad replies, without a second or third thought for anyone else in the room. Lily rolls her eyes.
Thanks.
Besides, you can't row to save your life, adds Rose, looking at our sulking sister. I'll be back as soon as I can, she says, before leaving the room.
She barely touched her food earlier, says my mother when Rose is gone. Has anyone else noticed how thin she has got? She hardly said anything to anyone all night, and she keeps looking at her watch.
I expect she can't wait to leave, Dad interrupts. I know the feeling, says Nancy, as I sit down beside her on the sofa. She's still watching the TV, hasn't taken her eyes off it the entire time, and I see that my 1970s family are no longer on the screen. It's just baby me, alone in my crib. My father must have forgotten to turn off the camera when this was filmed all those years ago.
Shall we stop watching this? Asks Lily, reaching for the remote.
No, wait, I whisper, as five-year-old Rose reappears in shot. She looks over her shoulder, then creeps nearer to the crib. We all seem to lean closer to the TV as little Rose leans down over the baby before checking over her shoulder one last time. We hang off her every word as she sings a sweet-sounding lullaby. Hush, little baby, don't say a word. Mama's gonna buy you a mockingbird. And if that mockingbird don't sing, gonna buy you a diamond ring. And if that diamond ring turns brass, Mama's gonna buy you a looking glass. Hush, little baby, don't you cry. Sometimes we live, sometimes we die. 5-year-old Rose reaches into her pocket and takes out what looks like a baby mouse. Baby mice are born hairless and pink. They are born blind and deaf and helpless. The creature squirms as Rose holds its tail between her fingers and dangles it over the crib before dropping it. The child inside, which I remember is me, starts to cry. My sister rocks the crib and smiles, before raising a finger to her lips. Then Rose walks out of shot. I feel as though everyone is staring at me, but I don't know what to say. I'd just been born. It isn't as though I can remember the incident or what happened next. The tape ends abruptly, ejecting itself from the VCR player, and the TV screen displays nothing except white noise. We all exchange glances and unspoken thoughts about what we just saw, but before anyone can say anything, we hear footsteps in the hall. The door to the lounge bursts open, and 34-year-old Rose reappears in the doorway, as though we have just witnessed some twisted form of time travel. She looks wet and wild and angry, and we all stare at her.
"The boat has gone," she says, sounding breathless. "The rope attaching it to the jetty looked like it had been deliberately cut. We're all stuck here until the tide goes back out."
Chapter 12. 31st of October, 12:45 a.m. Less than 6 hours until low tide. Everyone stares at Rose.
"Why are you all looking at me like that?"
Lily smiles.
"You just got caught."
Rose takes a step back towards the door.
"What?
Putting a baby mouse in Daisy's crib the first day they brought her home." Rose exhales, shakes her head as though relieved.
"Rose was just a child. Children do strange things sometimes. There's no need to drag up the past or upset anyone now. We have enough to deal with," says Nancy.
"Yes, like a missing bloody boat," says Connor, storming out.
I glance around the lounge and can see that everyone looks just as upset and exhausted as I feel. The fear and sadness in the room is like something solid and real, binding us together even though we might rather be apart. Our grief gives us something in common. They all had reasons to be upset with Nana, and not just because of the will. She could be a difficult woman to love sometimes. But I'm sure nobody in this family would have wished her dead.
"Rose is right. The boat is gone. It wasn't even mine," Connor says, reappearing in the doorway. "Maybe you didn't tie it to the jetty properly," my dad says.
Connor glares at him.
"I tied it just fine. You heard Rose. The rope looks as though it has been cut."
Dad nods.
"Well, looks can be deceiving. It's been a terrible night for us all. Everyone is tired. I don't think we should let our imaginations scare us into thinking what happened here tonight is anything more than it is. A tragic accident and a missing boat."
He stands, a little wobbly on his feet, I notice. Then he walks back over to the drinks trolley and pours himself another glass of whiskey. Liquid anaesthetic to numb the pain.
"And you wonder why we got divorced," mutters my mother beneath her breath, before tutting, which is one of her most favourite things to do. "Because I like whiskey?" he asks.
"No, because you're selfish. It doesn't even occur to you that someone else might like a drink."
Dad holds up the decanter.
"There's plenty for everyone.
They don't want whiskey. Why don't I make us all some tea?
Including you. Clear heads are what is required."
She leaves the room without asking who wants what. My mother has always been of the belief that a cup of tea can solve almost anything.
Bad day at the office? Have a cup of tea. Struggling to pay the bills? Have a cup of tea. Find out that your husband is cheating on you with a 20-year-old harpist? Cup of tea.
She forgot my birthday once, but my mother never forgets how a person takes their tea. It's oddly important to her. Although in our family, it is pretty easy to remember. She is the only one of us who takes sugar. As soon as she leaves the room, my dad takes another large gulp of his scotch.
What? He says to nobody in particular. My mother just died. I'm supposed to be upset, and I'm allowed to have a bloody drink if I want to.
No one argues with my father. It's never been a good use of time. Arrogance always translates his opinions into facts inside his head. Nancy returns with a tray after being gone longer than expected. I see that she swapped her black silk pyjamas for a black roll neck, cropped trousers and ballet pumps, one of her classic Hepburn ensembles. She's put on some makeup too, thick black eyeliner and a little blusher. I suppose everyone deals with grief differently. Her blue-veined hands are visibly trembling, and the tray rattles as she sets it down on the coffee table. Everyone takes their own cup. They have our names on them, hand-painted by Nana. Even Connor has his own.
Mum,
Trixie whispers, ignoring the cup of tea placed in front of her. My niece has been quieter than normal, and I wish I could have protected her from all of this.
Mm-hmm,
Lily says, without looking up.
I need the bathroom.
So why are you telling me about it?
Trixie frowns.
Because I'm scared.
I jump to my niece's defence before her mother can reply. I can't stand it when Lily bullies her own daughter.
I'll go with her, I don't mind. Nobody is going to go with you or hold your hand.
Lily snaps, ignoring me. No one says anything, but their eyes speak the words that their mouths don't.
There is no reason for you to be scared of going to the bathroom. You're 15, not 5. All those bloody books you read are putting silly ideas in your head. And there's no need to be scared of Nana anymore, darling. The old bat is dead.
Dad takes another sip of whiskey, and Nancy tuts again, louder this time. Neither of them was ever any good at telling my sister off when she was out of line, which is why she's never been in step with the rest of the world. It's almost as if they're scared of her.
You shouldn't speak ill of the dead, Nancy says.
Why?
Lily asks. You always speak ill of the living.
Go to the bathroom, Trixie. There's no need to be scared. It's just across the hall. Go on and grow up while you're at it, she says to her 15-year-old daughter who has just seen a dead body for the first time. Trixie glares at her mother, pushes her pink glasses a little further up her nose, and leaves the room.
I think we ought to come up with a plan, says Connor. I don't remember anyone asking what you thought, slurs my dad.
Surely we all just stay together until the tide goes out, says Rose. The rain outside lashes against the elderly glass in the windows, making it rattle inside its frame. Lily's teeth start to chatter as though it's contagious.
If we're staying down here until the sun comes up, then we'll need to keep warm, she says. Oh, this house is freezing.
My sister can always find something to complain about, but to be fair, she is only wearing a nightdress.
I'll get some jumpers from upstairs. Does anyone else want anything?
Looks are exchanged like unwanted gifts. Heads are shaken and shoulders are shrugged. Trixie returns, Lily leaves, my dad pours another drink, and my mother tuts again.
Is that really a good idea, Frank? She asks.
No, it's an excellent idea. Do you really think it was an accident?
Connor asks him.
Enough!
Dad snaps.
This isn't a crime scene for a BBC correspondent to report on or a murder mystery story for someone to solve. She was my mother. She slipped and fell. Simple as that. There was no murder. There is no mystery. She was 80, had already lost most of her marbles, and now she's dead. That's the end of it.
His face closes like a door. The conversation is over. Then Dad frowns and stares out of the window at the sea lit by moonlight, almost as though he has forgotten the rest of us are here.
Forgive me, I think I need to be alone for a while,
he says quietly. Lily returns with some jumpers and blankets and has dressed herself in jogging bottoms teamed with a tight top. Dad leaves the room as she enters it, taking his whiskey with him and closing the door. We hear him go into the music room, and a few minutes later, we all hear the familiar sound of him playing the piano. Even though he is drunk, he plays perfectly.
"I'm still cold,"
whispers Trixie, despite the jumper Lily has given her. It's the pink jumper from last night and matches her pyjamas. "I brought one of your books down for you," Lily says.
"I'm too upset to read."
"Suit yourself. Here, play with this, see if you can beat my highest score," Lily says. Trixie takes her mother's mobile phone and plays Snake, the glow of the screen reflected in her glasses and illuminating her sad little tear-stained face.
"I'll go and fetch some firewood," offers Connor. "I think we're in for a long night."
"Thank you, Connor," says Nancy with uncharacteristic sincerity. He's gone a very long time. I think maybe I'm the only one to notice until my mother speaks again.
"You don't think Connor is doing a runner, do you?"
I think she was trying to make a joke, but it doesn't quite land, and her face suggests she regrets it. Nana and Connor had a very special relationship. I don't believe he could be capable of hurting her. At least, not like that. She was the grandmother he never had, and we all knew how much she adored him. There was a time when Nana didn't just treat Connor like family. She treated him better. A year after appearing in Black Sand Bay, Connor would regularly turn up at Seaglass, with or without an invitation. So did I. My mother often felt the need to run away without much notice, sometimes visiting my father while he toured abroad. Sometimes none of us knew where she went. But I was always sent to Seaglass when my existence wasn't convenient for my parents' lifestyle. Not that I minded. I loved spending time here with Nana. So did Connor. I was a bit too young to hold his attention back then, so if my sisters were away at boarding school, he would amuse himself looking for crabs in the rock pool at the rear of the house. It was carved out, courtesy of the sea, from the natural stone Seaglass was built on, a private treasure trove of watery magic, starfish and crabs. Nana told us it was where fairies went to swim at night, while the rest of the world was sleeping. If the weather was bad, Connor could often be found indoors, helping Nana mix her paints. He and I were the only ones allowed in her studio, or playing with his yo-yo and staring out to sea. But one morning, Nana and I found him outside the back door, curled up asleep in the log store.
"Connor, it's 7 a.m. and it's freezing. What are you doing out here?"
Nana asked, squinting at the boy in the shadows. His only blanket was the night sky sequined with stars. There are no views of the bay or the mainland from the back of the house. All that can be seen or heard is the Atlantic Ocean. As soon as the sun goes down, the world outside of Seaglass's walls is cold and dark. The sea looked black, and the tide was in that morning, which meant that Connor must have been out there for hours. He knew better than to risk the rips and tides hiding beneath the surface of an unforgiving ocean.
"I didn't want to wake anyone," Connor said, staring at Nana. They had a silent exchange, which 5-year-old me was too young to understand.
"Come on, let's get you inside. I'll run you a hot bath so you can warm up."
"Why are you limping?"
I asked Connor as he followed Nana up the stairs. He smelled pretty bad too, and his blonde hair looked shiny and wet with grease. "Go to your room, Daisy," Nana said. She could see that I was about to protest. Being sent to my room was one of my mother's favourite forms of punishment, not Nana's, and I hadn't done anything wrong. Nana's face softened. "We can have jelly and ice cream with chocolate sauce for breakfast, but only if you go to your room," she said with a wink. So I did as I was told. But I couldn't resist creeping out onto the landing a little while later, and peeking through the crack where the bathroom door was open just enough to see. Nana used my bubble bath for Connor, not that I minded. The bottle looked like a smiley sailor called Matey, and it turned the water blue. I loved bubble baths, but Connor didn't smile or look happy at all. I watched as Nana helped him out of his jumper and shirt. He dressed like a middle-aged man when he was 10, and I saw the cuts and bruises all over his back. Connor looked ashamed, as though it was his fault. "Who did this to you?" Nana asked, already knowing the answer that Connor wouldn't give. She held his face in her hands. "You're going to be okay, I promise. You take the rest of your clothes off and pop them in this bin liner. I'm going to find you some clean, dry clothes and start making us all some breakfast. Call me if you need anything."
"Mrs. Darker," he said.
"Yes?"
"Please don't tell anyone. He didn't mean to do it."
Nana had her back to him, and I could see she had tears in her eyes. "I had a dad who didn't mean to hurt me, too, once upon a time. I promise you can trust me. For now, just have your bath. There's a clean towel and flannel on the side. Don't forget to wash behind your ears." I ran back to my bedroom before Nana came out onto the landing and listened to her march down the stairs. She was still wearing her fluffy purple dressing gown and pink slippers, but she looked really mad, and her face looking all cross like that made me feel a bit afraid. Nana was rarely angry about anything, but boy, did everyone know about it when she was. The only telephone at Seaglass in those days, or ever, was in the hallway. It was on a little round table, along with a fancy notebook full of handwritten numbers. I watched from behind the banister at the top of the staircase as Nana flicked through the book, found Connor's dad's number, and dialed. It was a rotary phone, so took forever. Her foot was tapping the way it did when she was proper cross, while she waited for someone to answer the call. Patience was never one of Nana's virtues. "Hello, Mr. Kennedy. How are you today?" "Oh, a little under the weather." "I'm sorry to hear that. Is that why you beat your 10-year-old son with your belt last night?" There was silence, in which I'm sure Connor's dad and I were both busy putting together pieces of a puzzle we weren't sure how to solve, wondering if those pieces were in the right order, not really liking the picture that they made. Nana went on. "I suspect you didn't even know where he was overnight. Let me put your mind at rest and tell you that he's here at Seaglass with me, which is where he is going to stay until I can reach social services and have him taken away from you forever." She was quiet again. I wished I could hear what was being said on the other end of the line. "He's her child. It's not his fault your wife died. You are supposed to be his father. You're supposed to protect him from all that is bad and wrong about the world, not constantly hurt him and let him down." "Doing your best? Well, your best isn't good enough. You're depressed? Aren't we all? It doesn't give you the right to do what you did. You are a disgrace to depression, and you don't deserve to call yourself that child's father. Either you get yourself some help, or you will lose your son. I never met your wife, but I can only imagine that if she could see what you have become, she would be deeply ashamed and wish she'd never met you. He's her son, all that is left of her. Think of that next time you take your shitty existence out on your child." Then she hung up, and I was both scared and in awe of her all at once. Nana never stopped looking out for Connor from that day on. His father went to AA, was in rehab for a while, and although there were months, sometimes years, when things would be okay, she always kept a close eye on Connor back then, trying to protect him. Back in the present, I get up and leave the lounge to find out where he has disappeared to. I immediately feel the slap of cold air, and the sound of the sea is louder than before, almost as though it is inside the house. When I step out into the hallway, I can hear the back door banging in the wind. Connor must have left it open when he went in search of wood. The quickest way to get to the log store is via the kitchen, but I don't really want to go in there. I don't want to see Nana's body on the floor again, or the unkind chalk poem on the wall, so I avert my eyes as I hurry to the back door. Connor walks through it before I get there, carrying a basket full of logs. He looks completely drenched, and I don't understand what took him so long. I'm about to ask when I notice him staring at something behind me. I think I know what it is, Nana, but when I turn to look for myself, I see that her body has gone. Connor puts the logs down and stares at the kitchen table. There is a VHS tape on it. One of the ones I'm sure I saw on the shelf in the lounge last night. Someone has stuck Scrabble letters to the front of its white cardboard case, spelling out the words, "Watch me." Next to the tape, there is a torn piece of paper. When I read the words that have been written on it, in handwriting I do not recognize, my whole body turns icy cold. Trick or treat the children here, before they scream and disappear. Chapter 13. 31st of October, 1 a.m. 5 hours until low tide. The clocks in the hallway all start to chime. Thankfully, just once, as it's 1 a.m., but they are a little out of sync, as usual. Connor stares at the space on the floor where Nana used to be, but there's no body and no blood, as though what we saw before might just have been a bad dream. Then he looks at the VHS tape and note on the kitchen table. He turns to look in my direction, but doesn't say anything, almost as if he suspects me of putting them there. I can still hear my dad's piano in the music room. He hasn't stopped playing since he locked himself away from the rest of us. The men in my life have never been good at using their words, so I find a few of my own. I understand why you've refused to see me for years, and why you still don't want to talk to me now, and that's fine. But can we please put what happened with us to one side just for tonight? I'd really like to know what you think is going on here, because I'm scared, I say, quietly enough so that the others won't hear. I used to think of Connor like a big brother, and I miss him playing that role in my life. The look on his face is opaque. There is no reflection or even an acknowledgement of what I just said. I hate that things have become so awkward between us, but I have never managed to find the right words to fix things. I don't understand why we can't move on, especially now. Everything we've just seen confirms that Nana's death was not an accident. I'm not naive. I know that everyone was upset about Nana's will last night, and I do have a hunch about what might be going on here. But hunches aren't just there to be had, they're there to be thought about, analysed, agonised over, and, most importantly, should rarely be shared. Connor stares at the words written on the piece of paper on the kitchen table, then at the VHS tape, then again at the place on the floor where Nana's body was earlier. I just stare at Connor. He grabs a red checkered tea towel from the kitchen worktop and does his best to dry himself off from the rain. Then he reaches inside his pocket and takes out a mobile phone. It's a dark blue Nokia, the best that 2004 has to offer, just like Lily's. But Connor seems to have forgotten that there is no signal here. He holds it high up in the air, as though that will make it work, but of course it doesn't. I watch as he strides out to the little table in the hallway where the landline used to live. The old pink rotary phone is still there, on a doily, but Nana wasn't joking when she said she stopped paying the bill. She wanted peace and quiet, and I guess she got her wish, because the phone is dead. I find the fact that Connor so clearly wants to call the police reassuring, despite knowing that he can't. There is a picture of me and my sisters by the phone. When they were here, it used to ring all the time. Most calls were for them. Friends from school wanting to catch up in the holidays, study partners for Rose, boyfriends for Lily. But occasionally it was my dad, calling from one city or another, between rehearsals and performances. He could never talk for more than a few minutes. Long-distance calls cost a small fortune in those days, and it never took him too much time to ask Nana for more money. Sometimes publishers called for Nana, and her agent always called to wish her a happy birthday. But I can remember one Halloween when I was the only person here to help her celebrate, and the phone rang. The person calling was Connor. I suppose I must have been 5 or 6. Nana had just blown out all of her candles. There were a lot, even back then. And we were about to eat pineapple upside-down cake with angel delight. The memory of that phone call is as clear now as if it had happened yesterday, not over 20 years ago. "Hello?" Nana said, answering the phone with a big smile, expecting it to be someone calling to wish her a happy birthday. The smile slid straight off her face. "It's going to be okay. You did the right thing calling me. Stay exactly where you are and I'll be there soon." "Who was it?" I asked. "Connor. Something's wrong. I need to go over there," Nana said, looking for her handbag. She could never seem to find it, even though it was both brightly coloured and enormous. The bag was made from pink and purple patches and was older than me. Nana shook her head while searching for it, and her curly white hair seemed to dance. I wondered if mine would look like that when I was older. Then I remembered that I would never be old enough to have white hair, and it made me feel so sad. It's odd, the little things that used to upset me. Most people don't want grey or white hair, but in that moment I did. Maybe people wouldn't complain about getting old all the time if they were scared that they never would. When Nana found her handbag, she slipped a wooden rolling pin inside it. "What should I do?" I asked, a little scared of being left on my own at Seaglass. Nana stared at me as though I had said something wrong. "Daisy Darker, do you care about Connor?" I nodded. "Good. I'm glad to hear it. Caring about other people is more important than being curious about them. When someone you care about is in trouble, you do everything you can to help, which means you are coming with me. Now, find your shoes and let's skedaddle."
"What about your birthday cake?"
I asked. "We'll take it with us. Connor sounds like he needs cheering up." 10 minutes later, having crossed the causeway when the tide was already fast coming in, the two of us climbed the rocky path with wet shoes and socks. At the top of the cliff, behind the sand dunes, there was an old shed where Nana kept her only form of transport. It was an ancient bicycle with a large wicker trailer attached to the back, which, now that I think about it, can't have been legal. I climbed into the wicker trailer and Nana climbed onto the saddle, dangling her handbag on the handlebars. Nana pedalled faster than I knew she could along the coastal road until we reached Connor's cottage, a mile or so away on the other side of Black Sand Bay. The place was really nothing more than a dilapidated 2-bedroom bungalow on a rocky stretch of the coast. One of the windows was cracked, and the blue paint on the front door was peeling right off. They'd moved there when Connor's mum died, and the building was as abandoned and unloved as the two people who lived in it. We didn't knock. There was no need. The door was open. I'd never been inside before. Connor always came to visit us, never the other way round. And I was shocked by what I saw. I think we both were. The front door opened straight into a little lounge, and there was mess everywhere. The previously white net curtains were a grubby grey, and when Nana switched on the light, the place looked even worse than it had in the gloom. The old green sofa in the middle of the room had sunken seats and holes in some of the cushions. There were dirty cups and plates stacked on the coffee table, and chip shop wrappers and crushed beer cans all over the stained carpet. Picture frames, which presumably used to hang on the rusty hooks on the walls, were smashed on the floor. They were all of Connor with his parents before his mum died. A broken, happy family. There were bits of glass and rubbish almost everywhere I looked. Connor was sitting in the corner of the room, hugging his knees to his chest.
"Where is he?" Nana asked.
"In the bedroom,"
Connor whispered without looking up.
"You stay with Connor," Nana said to me. "Be as kind to him as you would want someone to be to you if you felt broken."
And she took her rolling pin out of her pink and purple patchwork bag, and the way she held it made me think it wasn't so she could do some baking. I wanted to be kind to Connor, and I knew what it was like to feel broken. But I followed Nana, even though I knew I wasn't meant to. Curiosity doesn't only kill cats. The bedroom was dark and smelled bad. There were piles of clothes all over the floor and a filthy-looking man lying on the bed with his eyes closed. Empty bottles of pills were on the stained bedsheets beside him. Nana dropped the rolling pin and used the phone on the nightstand to call for an ambulance. He wasn't dead. He just wished that he was. Even though I was very young, the thought of anyone feeling that unhappy made me feel overwhelmingly sad. When the nice paramedics had taken Connor's dad to hospital, the three of us ate Nana's birthday cake. It seems like a strange thing to have done, looking back. But then, my childhood was rarely normal. Mr. Kennedy lived to tell the tale, and Nana paid for him to go to rehab.
We all get broken sometimes, and if you can help fix someone, you should always try, she said.
I think Connor's dad was a bit like me in that way. But he wasn't born with a broken heart. His heart broke when his wife died. Connor said he rarely drank at all before then, and that he used to be happy. They all were. Connor stayed at Sea Glass for a little while, and the three of us, him, Nana, and me, spent a week straightening out the cottage where he and his father lived. We cleared out all the rubbish and washed everything that could be cleaned. Nana pulled up the old carpet, sanded the floors, painted the walls inside and out, and bought some new cushions and bed linen. Nana was always of the opinion that if you could help change a life, you could help change the person who leads it. She put fresh flowers in every room and filled up the fridge and freezer with food before Connor's dad returned. She even paid for us all to take a taxi to collect him from rehab. He looked like a different man to me, so much so I thought we'd picked up the wrong person. He'd put on some weight, his clothes were clean, he'd shaved off his horrible beard, and he didn't stink of booze or cigarettes. "Are you sure you're Connor's dad?" I asked in the car, and everyone laughed, even though I hadn't been joking.
"Thank you," he said when he stepped inside the bungalow and saw how much work we had all done to make their house a home. "For everything. How can I ever repay you?"
"Just stay well," Nana replied. Then she shook hands with him, kissed Connor on the cheek, and we left them to try again.
"Everyone deserves a second chance," Nana said when we were alone.
"Even bad people?" I asked.
"Everyone you know is both good and bad. It's part of being human."
I think I was too young to understand at the time.
"Can you bring some matches as well as logs?" Lily calls,
sticking her head out of the lounge door, snapping me out of the past and back to a present that is no less upsetting.
"I think you should come and see this. All of you," Connor replies.
Lily tuts, one of many bad habits she inherited from our mother, then tells Trixie to stay behind while the rest of the women in the family join us in the kitchen.
"Where's Nana?"
asks my mother, staring at the floor where Nana's body used to be.
"Exactly," says Connor,
and we all look at one another.
"Did somebody move her?"
Everyone shakes their heads.
"Well, someone left this VHS tape and this note on the kitchen table," he says. "The words didn't write themselves."
Nancy picks up the scrap of paper and reads out loud. "Trick or treat the children here before they scream and disappear."
"What does that mean?" "Watch me," says Lily, picking up the tape and reading the Scrabble letters stuck to its cover. She puts it straight back down as though it might hurt her. "What is this? A sick version of Alice in Wonderland?"
"Nana disappearing isn't the only thing that's changed in here," says Rose, and we turn to see what she is staring at on the kitchen wall. The poem, written in chalk, is still there, but four of the lines have been crossed out. "Daisy Darker's Nana was the oldest but least wise. The woman's will made them all feel ill, which was why she had to die. Daisy Darker's father lived life dancing to his own tune. His self-centered ways and the pianos he played danced him to his doom."
"What is that supposed to mean?" Lily says, looking at our mother.
"Why are you asking me?
You came out here, alone, to make tea. Who else had time to do all of this?"
Nancy looks flustered for a second, but soon recovers.
"I think you'll find we all left the lounge alone at one stage or another. Rose went to the jetty, only to find that the boat was gone. You went to get jumpers from upstairs. Connor just went outside to fetch logs. Maybe he moved the body," she says.
"Or maybe it was Frank," Connor says in a hushed voice. "He's very upset, and he's had a lot to drink. Maybe he crossed out his own name so that
we'd all think he killed Nana," interrupts Lily. "Why would the murderer implicate themselves?"
"So you admit that a crime might have taken place here tonight, and that your Nana may have been murdered," Connor replies.
"From what I can tell, you all had a motive to kill her because you all needed her money and would have been furious about not getting a penny more of it. Money is why you're all here. Rose's veterinary practice is in financial trouble. Frank's orchestra costs more than it makes these days. Nancy's divorce settlement has dried up. And Lily has always sponged off the rest of the family."
"You arrived after Nana read us her will," interrupts Rose.
"So how did you know none of us were going to get the money? And why are you here?"
Lily asks. Connor glares at her.
"I have my reasons."
"Having your reasons is fine unless they are someone else's." I wish I could say it out loud, but I've never been as brave as people who say what they really think.
"That's enough, Connor. You can't go around accusing people of things you know nothing about. You don't know Frank the way the rest of us do. He was my husband and is still their father.
But I do think we need to talk to him," Nancy says. She starts walking towards the music room.
"Together," she adds, when none of us follow.
The piano music gets louder with every step we take towards the door. My mother gently knocks on it.
"Frank?"
There is no answer, so she knocks again, but the piano music continues to play. Nancy tries the door handle, but it's locked.
"Stand back," says Connor,
so we do.
Only Lily laughs when he tries and fails to force the door open by running at it.
Rose surprises us all then with a well-aimed kick that causes the door to fly open. But nothing is as shocking as what we see next. The piano is still playing, because it's one of those pianos that can play itself. My father is lying on the floor beneath it, with an empty whiskey glass in his left hand. His conductor's baton has been snapped in two and tied to his right hand with a red ribbon. His eyes are wide open, and he appears to have vomited blood. I feel numb and sick and confused. But I am certain of one thing. My dad is dead. Frank. Daisy Darker's father lived life dancing to his own tune. His self-centered ways and the pianos he played danced him to his doom. An unexpected pregnancy resulted in marriage and three girls. But instead of seeing his family, Frank chose to see the world. His orchestra was his one true love, and he thought they loved him too. But those out-of-work musicians just needed cash and something to do. Frustrated as Frank became about his own music not being performed, he carried on touring, though failure was boring, still hoping to be adored. While the family who truly loved him was abandoned and alone, it was all too late when he accepted his fate. He might have been happiest at home. When the time came, no one knew who to blame when he was found poisoned by his drink. It was hard to feel sad for an absent dad. His grieving girls didn't know what to think. Chapter 14. 31st of October, 1:05 a.m. Less than 5 hours until low tide. Rose switches off the piano and I'm glad. The sight of it playing all by itself with my father lying dead beneath it is an image I wish I could wipe from my memory forever. I notice that one of the piano keys has gone, like a missing tooth in a musical smile, almost as though the piano itself is laughing at us. The rain outside, lashing against the glass window, serves as white noise while we stand and stare in silence. He must have done it, Lily says quietly, as if scared he might hear her accusing him. He must have killed Nana because he was so upset about her will. Then he drank himself to death because of the guilt. Didn't he even joke last night that his preferred form of murder would be a sharp blow to the head? That's exactly how she died. My dad is many things, but I'm certain that a murderer isn't one of them. Why would he move Nana's body? I say. And where is she now? And what do the note and the VHS tape in the kitchen mean? Connor steps forward.
This doesn't look like suicide, if you ask me.
Nobody did, Lily replies. Are you sure he's dead? Yes, says Rose, closing my father's eyes. She takes the empty whiskey glass from his hand and sniffs it, before doing the same with the empty decanter on top of the piano. It seems like an odd thing to do.
Why would he tie his conducting baton to his own hand? Connor asks, looking at the rest of us as though we might be dangerously stupid. Why did he do any of the daft things he did? Nancy snaps, wiping a trickle of tears from her face with a pretty embroidered handkerchief from her sleeve. It has a letter B on it, and I presume it must be Nana's, or Trixie's, though nobody ever calls my niece Beatrice.
This all feels like a bad dream. It can't be real, my mother says, in a voice that sounds too small for her. What are we going to do? Why are you so upset? Lily asks.
Just because you chose to share your bed with him last night, which is disgusting, by the way, have you forgotten everything else that Dad did? He abandoned you years ago. He abandoned us all.
How can you speak like that when the man is lying dead on the floor? He was your father, and I loved him. Even when I didn't like him, I still...
I'm not going to pretend he was ever Dad of the Year just because he is dead.
I didn't raise you to behave like this, Lily. You barely raised me at all, and he certainly didn't have much to do with it. I was mostly brought up by strangers at boarding school. You dumped us here on Nana most holidays, while my so-called father spent his time with musicians half his age. The man is dead. Show some respect. For him. For yourself, Nancy says.
My mother always has an argument under construction, sometimes several at once. And if I had a hard hat, I'd wear one.
Lily wouldn't dare answer back if she hadn't had so much to drink tonight.
Just when I think it might be over, Nancy throws another verbal brick.
He stayed as long as he was able.
That's a good one. He didn't have to have kids. We didn't ask to be born. Plenty of people get pregnant by accident. I did,
Lily says.
Well, I didn't,
Nancy replies. And the room is even quieter than before.
I knew your father was going to choose music over me, even when we were students. I got pregnant on purpose so that he'd marry me,
so that he'd have to stay. My sisters and I try to process this latest bombshell, but it's all a bit much to take in. Finding Nana dead in the kitchen earlier, now Dad in the music room. It's like a messed up family edition of Clue. But this isn't a game. Two people have died here tonight. I think part of me always suspected that Nancy deliberately got pregnant and tricked Dad into marrying her. But hearing her say it out loud is surreal. Half of me hates her for it, while the other half knows I never would have been born if she hadn't.
So he didn't really want any of us? Asks Rose.
That explains a lot. He loved all of you in his own way, Nancy says. I just can't believe he would do this.
Maybe he didn't, Connor says.
Nancy stares at him.
The door was locked. There was nobody else in the room.
The door could have been locked from the outside, he replies calmly. Either way, the police will have to be called now.
Everyone looks scared for the first time, and I can't help wondering why it took so long.
Connor is right, says Rose, always in control of her emotions. We will have to involve the police when we can. It's only 5 hours until low tide now. We'll leave together in the morning and call for help. In the meantime, maybe we could all just... try to be kind to each other?
We should go back to the lounge. Trixie is on her own in there, she adds, taking charge like before.
After everything that has happened here tonight, I'd feel a lot better knowing that we are all safe and together in one room.
My eldest sister often took charge of situations when we were children, and the fact that she is doing so now feels like a relief. I pretend not to notice, but I see her tap Connor on the arm as we are all leaving the music room and feel a stab of inexplicable hurt when he hangs back. They don't speak until they think the rest of us have returned to the lounge, but unknown to them, I'm waiting quietly out in the hall. I have to strain to listen and cover my mouth with my hand to stop myself making a sound when I hear what they say.
You are right. We do need to call the police, Rose whispers.
Why do you agree with me all of a sudden? Connor asks. No animal I know shares the human capacity for self-harm, but this wasn't suicide.
Why do you say that?
Sadly, I often see poisoned pets in my line of work. People can be monsters.
It's one of the many reasons why I prefer animals. Dad is the only person in the family who drinks whiskey. When I smelled his glass, it didn't just smell of alcohol. My father was poisoned. It was murder. I'm sure of it. I don't say a word. But I do wonder why Rose would choose to confide in Connor and not the rest of us. And why neither of them wanted to share that information with me. The shadow of a thought lingers in my mind and I can't seem to shake it. Not that I'll ever say anything to either of them about it. I only self-destruct in private. Back in the lounge, Trixie has fallen asleep on the large window seat at the far end of the room. It's one of my niece's favourite spots in the house, and she can often be found curled up there with a blanket and a book. Poppins, the dog, is stretched out on the floor beside her, gently snoring. It breaks my heart that such a kind child could have been born into such a cruel family. I'm glad she's sleeping now. Hopefully she'll stay that way until we can all leave. I think that Rose is looking at her too, but it turns out she was looking at the dog. Poppins is taking all of this very well, poor old girl, she says, to nobody in particular. On hearing her name, Poppins comes to sit next to Rose. That's a good point. What will happen to the dog now that Nana is dead? Lily asks. I'll take her with me, Rose replies without hesitation. You said that as if you'd already thought it through. We sit in silence for a while. I don't think any of us know what to say. I look at each of their faces and see a mix of fear, shock, and sorrow on every one. Rose strokes the dog and stares at the flames in the fire with an expression I've never seen her face wear. Connor stares at Rose. Despite throwing another log on the fire, Nancy can't seem to stop shivering. Lily goes to sit next to her and they hold hands. They have one of those mother-daughter relationships where they squabble all the time, but never stay cross with each other for long. It's another thing that I've always been jealous of. Are you all right? Nancy asks her favourite daughter. Lily shakes her head. No, of course not. Oh, it's just so awful. I think I'm in shock. We all must be. I meant, you look pale. Are you feeling okay? I can't find my diabetic kit, but don't worry. Missing one shot of insulin won't kill me. Lily wasn't diagnosed as diabetic until her early 20s. She injects twice a day now and makes sure that everyone knows it. I've spent a lot of time with diabetics at the care home where I volunteer, and I feel for them, I really do. It isn't an easy disease to live with at any age. But Lily doesn't take her condition as seriously as she should, and her sweet tooth and habit of overindulgence was demonstrated again at dinner. My sister rarely worries about the things that she should. Look how peaceful Trixie looks, Lily says, staring at her daughter. I don't know how I'm going to tell her what has happened. First Nana, then Dad. Maybe you don't have to tell her. Let her sleep for now, Nancy suggests. Lily nods, and I watch her quietly place a blanket over Trixie with unusual care and compassion. For a moment, I feel guilty about the bad thoughts I so often have about my sister. Maybe she is capable of loving someone more than she loves herself. Lily gently kisses her daughter on the forehead and strokes her hair in a rare display of maternal affection. What do we do with this? Asks Connor. He's holding the VHS tape from the kitchen with the words, "Watch me," on the front. We all stare at it and him as though he's holding a grenade and has suggested pulling out the pin. Throw it on the fire? Suggests Lily. Why would someone leave that there for us to find? I ask. Who
put it there is the question we should all be asking, says Connor. And what if it explains what is happening here tonight?
It just looks like another darker family home movie, Rose replies, as Connor removes the tape from its cover. We can all see the white sticky label on the side of it. Sea Glass, 1980, written in Nana's swirly handwriting. Rose takes the tape from Connor's hands.
Should we watch it?
Asks my mother. The rest of us exchange glances.
What else are we going to do for 5 hours? Sitting here in silence while we wait for the tide to go out will only make the hours pass more slowly. And things surely can't get any worse.
Personally, I'd welcome any distraction to take my mind off what has happened here tonight. And it might be nice for all of us to remember happier times.
What about Trixie?
Connor asks, looking at the sleeping teenager in the corner of the room.
Shall I turn the volume down?
Oh, don't worry, nothing wakes her when she's like this. She'll be out for the count until morning, Lily replies.
Is that normal for a teenager?
It is when I've given her a strong sedative.
You did what?
Connor looks genuinely shocked, but the rest of us barely react. All families have their own version of normal, and I confess that ours is a little different from most. Lily shrugs. I asked Nancy to crush one of her pills and put it in Trixie's tea earlier.
I used to secretly give my daughters sleeping pills all the time when they were kids,
Nancy interrupts as though proud of the fact. And we turned out just fine, says Lily with a large dose of irony. She smiles before turning to our mother.
I remember catching you putting the pills inside gummy bears, so we thought it was a bedtime treat before brushing our teeth.
Mine were hidden inside green bears. Rose got the red ones. Daisy's were always gold. We never questioned it, just did as we were told.
Trixie wouldn't stop crying after finding Nana. Hopefully she'll just sleep now until the tide goes out and we can leave.
I wish I could do the same.
Lily opens a new packet of cigarettes, her fingers shaking with impatience while she lights one.
Any guilt I felt regarding my feelings about her evaporates.
Nobody says anything about Lily smoking or the fact that she drugged her own daughter to stop her from crying. We all have bad habits. Some we let the world see, some we only reveal with family, and some we're too ashamed to share with anyone except ourselves. She lights up and instantly looks calmer, appearing to breathe out her unease with a puff of smoke. Connor shakes his head, but Lily ignores him. Rose, I think, sensing that a distraction might be good for the whole family, switches on Nana's old TV set. It slowly comes to life, displaying fuzzy grey and white pixels.
The tape says watch me, so
let's see what happens when we do, she says, sliding the video into the VHS machine, which swallows the tape whole. An image fills the screen, and it feels like the past is coming back to haunt us all.